There's probably a little bit too much fuss made about scores.
I think I'm a farmer deep down at heart. I wanted a family endeavor.
It's not about what someone else says. It's not about what rating it got. It's about what you enjoy drinking.
Wine to start with is something that is social.
It's about networking. It's about calling up people and ask for advice. And everybody's willing to help out.
Consumer wants something that's uncomplicated about wine. Why do you want one more thing to worry about?
I would trade this for nothing. It is my life and it is my dream.
You know, you only get to make one wine a year. It's not very much. I've been making wine most of my adult life, you know. It's only 35 Cabernets. I don't think that's a lot. I'm up for more.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle. And welcome to the third April Podcast 2012, number 57. For this program, we feature Bruce Regalia, winemaker for Cliff Family Vineyards on Howell Mountain.
Very likely, you've either seen or enjoyed the well-known Cliff Bar energy snack. So who would have imagined that wine could be a first cousin to this famous treat? Velo Vino, which is located in St. Helena, is the tasting room for Cliff Family Wines. And when visiting, you'll be treated to a display of every type of Cliff Bar you could imagine, as well as an amazing display of owner Gary Erickson's bikes. And, of course, Cliff Family Wines. We visited with Cliff Family winemaker Bruce Regalia at Velo Vino in February of 2012. Bruce's story is just as unique as the brand. So here's a bit of his history and a lot of his humor. So I'm here with Bruce Regalia of Cliff Family Wines, and we're at Vino. How's it pronounced, actually?
Velo Vino.
Velo Vino. Sorry, I got it backwards.
Yeah, it's common.
We're at the tasting room, which is known as Velo Vino, which is just about in the heart of St. Helena, which is very cool. Thanks for taking the time on President's Day, which would be most people's day off, and winemakers get a lot of days off, right?
Sometimes. It's seasonal. It depends on what time of year it is, but I have a pretty organized schedule.
Well, you're not in the middle of harvest, which is a good thing, so nobody would schedule an event like that in the middle of harvest. So you've been with Cliff for only a couple of years, right?
2 years, yeah. Okay. Last 2 years.
And I guess I want to actually go back to your beginnings. When did you become a winemaker, and what was there a moment that all of a sudden, you know, wine just kind of got into your blood?
Well, not really. I mean, I grew up in an Italian family, so we always drank wine from the time we were little. You know, we were always allowed to taste wine. And so wine was never a huge deal, but it was a part of every day. I mean, we drank wine at dinner every day. And I was always interested in fermenting things, you know, whether it was fruit juice or different things. I like to see CO2 coming off a liquid.
Really?
Yeah, and so I always liked fermenting things, but when I went to college, like a lot of people, I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I didn't even know that was something that you could do at the time. And so I liked being outdoors, so I got a degree in plant and soil science with the emphasis in viticulture and pomology, and a degree in botany. And so I kind of by accident stumbled into farm management. So my first job out of college, I was actually an entomologist for a huge farming company, and kept track of all the bugs on 2,000 acres of walnut and almond orchards in northern Sacramento Valley. That one ranch was actually part of Leland Stanford's old grape plantings up in northern Sacramento Valley. And Leland Stanford was a huge landowner. In the 1800s, he went to Bordeaux, and he came back, and he loved the Bordeaux wines. And so he brought people from Bordeaux to Sacramento Valley and planted 10,000 acres of grapes there. And it was not very successful because he didn't realize that it was too hot for, you know, certain varietals. And he didn't put all that together. But there were still remnants of those vineyards. Ranches, it had all been split up, but in ranches in the area. And so this one ranch had 10 acres of Cabernet. And so the guy I worked for, you know, was kind of a landscape block more than anything in front of this house. They never did anything with the fruit. They sprayed it. And so he gave the fruit to a friend of mine and myself. And so we crushed a couple of tons of it and made some pretty bad wine. I stored it in a friend's gold mine in Butte Creek outside of Chico, and he started saying, you know, after two bottles, that stuff's pretty good. And that's pretty much how it was.
The more you drink, the better it tastes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was like one of those things, but it piqued my interest. And, you know, like most home winemakers, you know, it's easy to make the wine. Taking care of it is hard. And so that's where most people fail, you know, at the beginning, as you know, cellaring wine is lots harder than making wine. And so, you know, I eventually got a job in Anderson Valley managing a 250-acre vineyard when Anderson Valley wasn't that well known. It was, you know, mid-80s or so, and Tony Hush was there before that, and Darren Edmeads and Dr. Edmeads, and there was a few small things going on, but there wasn't much going on. Navarro was there at the time, and then when I got there, Roeder moved in, and so that was a huge thing for Anderson Valley. And so while I managed that vineyard, all my neighbors had little wine, you know, little places to make wine. So my next door neighbor, Hans Kobler, told me, hey, you got to make a couple of barrels of wine for yourself every year so you have something to drink every night and you're not paying $20 a bottle for it. And so I did.
I like that a lot. Yeah. What a great idea.
So we made house wine. I made wine with a lot of people. And at that time, I sold a lot of fruit to Scharfenberger, which was in Ukiah at the time, and they were just starting up. And so I got to be friends with Rob McNeil, who's now the GM of Mum, but you know, I learned a lot about the technical side of winemaking from him, and also from Tom Lane, who was a winemaker at Navarro. You know, we became good friends, and I was delivering fruit there all the time. So like in between loads, I did lab work there, and you know, so that part of it, I was kind of self-taught, but you know, I always hung out with people much smarter than myself. And so that's kind of how I learned how to make wine. You know, I wasn't trained in school to do it, but I always liked doing it. And I had a client that I was selling fruit to at the time too, Paul Obster, who had a place in Half Moon Bay. And so he bought a piece of property in Anderson Valley. And when I left Valley Foothills, the place I was farming, he offered me a job developing his vineyard. And so I was developing this new block for him, and he hired this winemaker, I think it was July. Then he couldn't get along with the guy. It was just, they had bad chemistry. Like, Paul didn't like to get wet, and every time this guy put a hose down, the nozzle would spray him in the back of the head. You know, it's just like one of the
funny. Yeah,
yeah, it was. Yeah, it was kind of comical. But so every time I'd sing and go, oh man, I don't know. I feel bad. I know I can't work with this guy. You know, I just hired him. I don't want to fire him, but it's not going to work. You know, why don't you be the winemaker? I told him, well, I'm not trained. He said, that's all right. I've tasted your wines, you know. You can do it. So he talked me into doing it. So that's how I became a winemaker. You know, that was strictly by accident. And at that time at Davis, it was two separate things. You know, winemaking, the enology program was more of food science, and then the viticulture was more of plant science. And they really didn't mingle. So I was one of the first people that I knew that went the other way, that was a viticulturist first and then learned how to make wine. And in those days, we didn't talk about terroir and all that. I mean, we hadn't figured it out in the United States yet. So people were, yeah, you get grapes, you get juice, you make wine out of it, where there wasn't that much attention paid to the vineyard like there is now. And so I worked for Paul Obster. I think I made 7 vintages for those guys. And then Paul loved to fly fish, and he used to like to go all over the world fly fishing. And so working kind of got in the way of that. And so,
wow, too bad.
Yeah. So he decided, hey, I'm going to try to sell the winery. And he didn't really list it, but it was kind of a pocket list. And it was one of those things that, like, if anybody gives me enough money for it, I'll sell it.
Sure.
So I met Alex Ryan and David Duckhorn. And David at the time was the CFO of Duckhorn Vineyards, and Alex was the operating officer. And so I met them. They came, started nosing around. And so I knew that, you know, something was going on. And so I always kidded them about it later, because it was like a 4-month interview. They'd come around, they'd ask me a few things, you know, and they were trying to get information from me.
Oh, yeah.
You know, which, yeah. You know, I didn't have any secrets. I'd tell them, you know, what I knew about Pinot Noir and Anderson Valley, and, you know, the way things went. And the thing about Anderson Valley is it's a very politically charged atmosphere. And so as a newcomer coming in from Napa Valley, it's tough to do business. And so it behooved them to have somebody that knew the lay of the land and knew how to grease the skids. And so that became me. So I became the general manager, brand manager, and winemaker of Goldeneye, and made those wines from the inaugural vintage till 2002 was the last vintage I made. And then I went out on my own, as it were. And God, this is a complicated story. So So at the time, the vineyard development was done by Madrigal Vineyard Management Company, who was farming all the duckhorn stuff in Napa Valley. So I brought them up to Anderson Valley. And, you know, so that's how I met Jess Madrigal and Chris and the Madrigal family. And they offered me a job to make some Pinot for them. And they had a small brand at the time they were doing at Napa Wine Company. So I started making some wine for them. And then in 2006, that was the last vintage we did at Napa Wine Company. They built the winery. So in 2007, they opened the winery up in Calistoga, and I took that over. So I started making all of their wines. And then I just started picking up clients along the way. I mean, I've been pretty fortunate and that I get to make wine from a lot of different places. But everybody that I work for, I love. You know, I mean, I actually like hanging out with them and going out to dinner with them. You know, even though it's like having different bosses because everybody has different expectations, yeah. It's good because I do really enjoy hanging out with all of them. 2 years ago, what year is it? 2012. I think in 2009, yeah, April's ago, I started working with Sarah Gott. She was making the wines here. And so she wanted to back out a little bit. And so she asked me to come on board. And so, you know, we started doing it together, and the transition has been pretty good. And so we still taste together and whatnot. And, consult with each other, if you will. And
that word consult.
Consult, you know, it's a funny word, but, you know. And so So I took over the wine program, and, you know, we've done a couple of different things. Last harvest, and not the harvest of 2011, but 2010, closed escrow on a vineyard up on Howl Mountain, which is, we're really excited about that. It's a gorgeous Cabernet vineyard, and the first wines from that vineyard will be bottling this summer. And so we'll get a, you know, chance. And we've had two hard vintages there. 2010 and 11 weren't exactly the premium harvests to start off with. So, I mean, I'm encouraged because the wines from there, even in bad years, are turning out well. So that's pretty exciting. So we're going to be creating a new brand around that Howl Mountain cab.
An actual new brand. Is that going to be under Cliff?
That remains to be seen. Yeah, it hasn't been branded yet, but it will be a separate higher-end Cabernet that we'll be making out of that vineyard.
Okay, so folks, you heard it here first. I want to go back to one thing you had said. Pomology, what is that?
Pomology is a study of home fruits, you know, if you will, growing apples, pears.
I never knew there was such a thing.
Yeah, there is. Oh, yeah. There is.
Oh, I learned something new with that one. The whole idea that you were a Goldeneye and my experience up there, that place has obviously really changed because obviously that was before the winery itself was built up to what it is right now.
Yeah.
So big changes up that way.
Well, yeah. Anderson Valley in general. I mean, I'll tell you, it was funny because when we started Goldeneye, the approach we took was, hey, we're going to have a 10,000 case brand. And so we wrote a white paper for all the investors at the time, you know, because we had to go out and get the money. And so, you know, in those times, money was more freely available. And so what we would do is we'd do a capital call. So we'd say, hey, we need $2 million. If you own 20% of the stock, you owed 20% of $2 million if you wanted to hold your position in the company. And we never had a problem raising money. And so we wrote a white paper for this 10,000 case ultra premium Pinot brand. And when we wrote the paper, we had no idea what we were doing as far as stylistically or, you know, what we wanted to accomplish in that way. But everybody was on board for it. And then we decided, well, maybe we need another site too. And so we bought another ranch, and then maybe we need another one. And so, you know, by the time that was all said and done, we had 5 ranches spread throughout the valley. And grower that grew fruit for us that actually I met when he had rootstock, so let me pick out all the clonal materials and all the blocks I wanted. So that was kind of the beginning. And we were doing a little bit of stuff in the Russian River in the shareholder's vineyard and just tasting wine a lot and trying to figure out what we were going to do. And so, you know, going from the original ranch to all those other ranches made us the case production go up all of a sudden.
Quite a bit.
And you know, then we started getting into vineyard designated wines. But everybody, when I told them we were going to charge $42 for a bottle of Pinot Noir, they just thought I was crazy.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, it was just like, and I always tell this story, in the 80s or something, Ted Bennett that owns Navarro, you know, I used to sell him a lot of Pinot Noir. And back then you could buy Pinot Noir for like $700 a ton, you know, sometimes less because people couldn't sell it. And so Ted said to me, you know, my dream, at that time, I think his Pinot was like $10, you know, that he was selling.
Yeah.
And he's going, my dream is to make a $15 bottle of Pinot Noir. And when I look back at it, I saw him at dinner one night, you know, gave him a $50 bottle of Anderson Valley Pinot Noir. And, he's like, and I reminded him of that. And he just, you know, started cracking up. But the whole mentality changed. Then everybody tried jumping in there. So you sure. saw different companies come in there, you know, Cliff Letty buying Brago and Ferrari Carano buying Lazy Creek and all these places that had been established and kind of jumping on the bandwagon. Then everybody's trying to make $100 bottles of wine.
Sure.
And, you know, that's a small niche. But, you know, when I was at Golden, I don't know how many calls I got from people telling me they wanted to plant a vineyard. They wanted to make the best bottle of Pinot Noir in the world. Mm. And they wanted us to finance the planting. So, you know, you would have to like explain it to them. But, well, that's not exactly how it works, you know?
Well, that's sort of like everybody wants to be famous, right?
Yeah, that exactly. Kind of So the mentality there changed. And, you know, Anderson Valley's, you know, it depends if you think it changed for the good or the bad. I think, you know, Pinot Noir is a hard thing to make, and it's hard to make well, and it's hard to do well all the time. And so you have to have the resources to do it and be prepared to lose money doing it before you make money. Whenever I take on new clients, the first thing I try to do is talk them out of doing it,
yeah,
you know, because, well, because a lot of people come from another business,
sure.
you know, and they're, okay, it's my dream to have 10 acres of premium Pinot Noir and have a, you know, 2,000 case brand. And it's a great lifestyle. It's not a great moneymaker. And, you know, it's a tough cutthroat business, and you don't realize it till you get, you know, if you're just drinking the wine, you think, oh, this is great. Or you go visit a winery and barrel taste. You know,
it's all the romance.
Yeah, it's the romance of it. And so it's a lot of people have taken it on. Not that many people have been successful at it. Let's say that. And, you know, Pinot Noir is hard to make a lot of good wine. You know, there's not really producers out there that are making, you know, 50,000 cases of phenomenal Pinot Noir. You know, most of the productions are pretty small, and there's a reason for that.
Sure. Well, and it's also a matter of finding good Pinot. That's yeah. to me the big issue. I did an interview with a Madonna last night, and they were talking about the idea, you know, they're making some very nice Pinot.
Yeah.
I've tried a lot of Pinot from around the area, and not everything is great. When you find a great one, you grab onto it, but you're usually going to pay a premium price for it.
Yeah. I mean, that's what happens too. When something becomes popular as a grape varietal, people plant it.
Right.
And sometimes it's not where it should be planted. And so then it's a matter of cherry picking. You know, like the Sonoma Coast is a perfect example of an appellation that is huge. And Sonoma Coast is not Sonoma Coast, is not Sonoma Coast. You know, if you're out where Flowers is, that's the Sonoma Coast. If you're inland in Sebastopol, you can still grow good fruit there. But it's kind of a misnomer to have it in the same appellation. So you have to know. You know, I always tell people it's better to know producers than vintages or anything else, because if you find someone that makes wine that you like, you're probably always going to like their wine. They're always going to try hard. And even in a horrible vintage like 2011, especially, it's important because the people that try hard and do a good job always do the best they can, even in a horrible vintage. So that's going to be the best the vintage has to offer, whether it's your favorite vintage or not, is something else. But
yeah. That's great advice from a winemaker, the idea of knowing the producer. With this change in the appellation on Russian River, do you have any concerns about that, or do you have any opinions about that with it being expanded?
No, I don't think it should be expanded. You know, for me, an appellation should be based on drainage of watersheds and on geography and geology. And it's got to be more of a marketing thing than, you know, if I could glom my ranch onto the Russian River appellation, I'd do it too. And that's kind of what happens. You know, when Anderson Valley Appellation was formed, it was kind of formed by whoever was sitting at the table when the line was drawn, say, oh, my ranch is there, and make sure it's in there. You know, I mean, that's why Greenwood Ridge is in the Anderson Valley Appellation. For me, it's more of a scientific thing. I mean, it should be based on geology, geography, climate, and the watershed. And it's kind of gotten away from that. So, you know, it's more disturbing for people on the East Coast, I think, because you order Damal Pinot from Russian River that you're in love with, and then all of a sudden you get a Pinot from you know, say Geyserville or something. It's that's a huge spread of right. climate change, yeah. and the wine is going to be different. And
totally.
And so you have to over educate yourself about appellation as a consumer. It just confuses people.
So do you think it's fair to say that what's been done is going to be damaging to the brand of the Russian River?
I think it will overall. I mean, I think, you know, producers that have been there for a while, it probably doesn't affect them as much as,
sure.
you know, the
somebody who's established.
Yeah, you know, like someone like Rocchioli or, you know, William Selling or someone. Yeah, to them, it probably doesn't matter. You know, they have established a brand. To people establishing new brands, it might be a little bit of a detriment.
Yeah, and I don't want to go anywhere politically there. I was just more, because you know, I know it was talked about for a long time, and I know a lot of people were against it. And as a wine drinker, to me, it just seems silly to...
Well, and you know, we're pretty provincial. So when you sell wine around the United States, to a lot of people, it only matters whether it says California.
Yeah, true.
You know, I mean, it could be Lake County, it could be what, and, you know, at a certain price point. So if you're spending below a certain amount on a bottle of wine, they just want it to be a good bottle of wine. They don't care if half of it's from Lake County and half's from Fresno. You know, it doesn't matter. And in fact, you have more blending liberty, if you will, to, you know, make more interest in wines. I was at Pinot Noir conference, and I've tried to float this idea twice, once in Burgundy and once in Oregon at this conference, and I tried to get everybody to put wines together from all over the state and make a California Pinot.
A real California.
Yeah, that rivaled anything, you know. So take fruit from Russian River and Santa Maria and, you know, the Central Coast and all over, and have people donate wines to make the best Pinot Noir available. And,
I think that's a fabulous idea.
Oh, it is.
That would sell like crazy.
Oh, no, but people, yeah, you have to do the marketing on it. And I tried floating that at a dinner party in Burgundy one day, and they almost crucified me.
I was just saying, like, that thing.
Oh, you want us to put our Romani Conti in their Mercury?
Yeah.
You know,
it's like, it's not going to go over well. No.
I was drinking though, and I just floated the ideas. Yeah,
you drink? Really? Just the whole idea of it's sort of like communal living in wine. No,
yeah,
that's not going to happen.
No, people don't like it. I mean, and you know, it's funny because for Van Williamson and I think for 2 or 3 years in Anderson Valley, we put together these composite barrels for charity. And so what we would do is we'd ask all our friends, "Hey, send us a 750 of a wine you're willing to give up to 15 gallons of." And so we would sit down at a table and taste all those, and then we'd high grade all the ones we liked, and then we put together wines, I think two years, maybe three, that were phenomenal. And to this day, that's still the best Anderson Valley Pinot Noir I've ever tasted.
Really?
Yeah.
I'll be damned. That's a fascinating area to me. I mean, that was my first exposure of it, to stay up there, which was wild, by the way.
Boy, yeah.
It gets really dark up there.
Yeah,
it just gets dark. It gets blind up there. But Anderson Valley is really, in some ways, maybe a sleeping giant. But there's some awfully good wine being there. You mentioned Hush and obviously Navarro and Roeder. And so there's a lot of good stuff going on up there. And yet it doesn't have the traffic. And the natural beauty is just insane.
Yeah, well, there, you know, the thing with Anderson Valley, too, is it's hard to get anything done there politically. So no one's ever going to build a big hotel there, you know, there's bed and breakfasts, but so there's certain restrictions, and the amount of plantable land has kind of been tapped out as far
that's
as
what it looks like. Yeah.
What's, you know, what makes sense to plant, and, you know, with engineering, I mean, if you're ever going to get your money back. I mean, it's kind of Napa Valley, you know, you just start planting on hillsides and, you know, put engineering, and you have, pretty soon you have $50,000 an acre before you've even done anything. So it becomes expensive and, you know, prohibitive if you want to make money. You know, if you're doing it for a lifestyle thing, you're a retired doctor and you want to have your 4 acres of, you know, you can make sense of that. But as far as going out and getting investors and telling them, hey, you're going to get a return on your money.
Well, some people are getting into it, I'm sure, for the idea of money. You got to make money.
Yeah.
You're going to have a business. But the other side of it is the romance and sort of the status of it.
Yeah. And a lot of times, you know, it's the kids of the winery owners that are going to make the money, because it is a long term deal. I mean, people that think they're going to jump in and make money right away, they're fooling themselves. You have to work hard at it and establish distribution and, you know, a good marketing plan and know where you're going. And that's the thing. A lot of people don't know where they want to get to, so they don't know how to get there.
So let's talk specifically about Clif, the wines you're making. Big fan of your cab, for what it's worth here. Really love what you guys are doing.
It's going to get better, too, now that we own the vineyard, because we've been buying fruit and sourcing fruit from different places, but there's nothing like having control of your fruit source. And so Howl Mountain Properties is going to open up a lot of possibilities. And also, we planted 2 acres of Zin up on Ink Grade at Gary and Kit's house at the ranch up there. And we're putting 2 selections of Zin up there that'll be the source for Gary's Improv. So we're going to be able to control those 2 wines start to finish, which is pretty exciting.
That would be basically, what, the 12 vintage then?
The Zin Vineyard is going to be grafted this year. So we won't see wines off of that till 2014. Probably the first cabs from Howl Mountain will be bottled this summer. So, and we'll probably see those, and, you know, they'll be released a year later. It's interesting because there's 3 blocks there, and we have clone 337, 4 and 7. And so I've been able to ferment them all separately. So I kept them all separate. So they're all separate lots, and they really do have interesting differences in character and body and the structure of them. And, you know, I'm trying to figure out what that site does. And I was lucky enough to be able to taste wines with the previous winemaker, Tim Milos, who was making the wines from that property. And he's, you know, pretty forthcoming and not too secretive about what he was doing. So, you know, I talked to him about what coopers he liked for that property and how he had been making wine out of there. And I got to taste through 4 vintages of his wines with him. And so, I, you know, right there, I learned a huge amount of knowledge, you know, that I would have had to figure out for myself.
What a great way to do a transition, to be able to get that kind of help. Again, one thing we've talked about a lot with Life Between the Vines is this idea of cooperation. Yeah, there's not a lot of people playing their cards too close to their vest. When you got a transition like that, that makes your job a little bit easier.
Yeah.
And maybe even that much more exciting, because you kind of get a better picture where you're going, right?
Yeah, and you know, for me, there's no secrets. I mean, I could tell somebody everything I do and they can't do it, you know, and someone can tell me everything they do and they can't do it, because it's like cooking, you know. I could give you all the same ingredients and you can't replicate my spaghetti sauce even if I give you the same recipe. It's going to be different. It just is. I had friends in Oregon that took fruit from the same Pinot vineyard, took it to their respective wineries, made the wine, and then we tasted them all. And you wouldn't even know they're from, they have a common thread running through them, but that's it, you know.
Wow, that's amazing. One thing you did when you and I met, which was at a dinner during auction last year, which was in 2011. And you gave us a great opportunity, the guests that were there, to do our own blend.
Yeah, that's always fun.
We had everybody had a lot of fun. And not only that, but it was smart, just because it gave everybody a chance to meet other people, because many people paired up with people they didn't know. What a fascinating process, because when we sat down, all of a sudden, it was with a couple of women, and we felt kind of blind. Where is your palate at this point? I mean, you talked about these vineyards, these three separate vineyards that you had in front of you. Is it just strictly how your palate is hitting you? Is it there's some kind of special process you go through when you think of blending? Or is it just simply how it comes together?
A little bit of both. I mean, you have some control over it. So the way I approach it is I keep all my lots separate. So like at Madrigal this year, I have 80 lots of wine. You know, so there might be 20 cab lots and 4 Zin lots, but I keep them separate and kind of evaluate them as individuals, especially working with a new vineyard. So for the vineyard on Hell Mountain, I'm trying to figure out what wood works, you know, some barrels. So I have a barrel trial going on within there. And so it takes me a while to figure that out. But when I'm tasting through the barrels every time, I get to a point where I go, this is the base wine. This is the skeleton I'm going to hang all the other pieces on. And so I kind of approach it that way. And then I make sure I'm not fooling myself, because some days you'll taste it, and you know, man, that's great. And the next time you taste it, it's not so good. And you know, I don't know if there's anything to this, but I have a friend that does everything biodynamically in Burgundy. And he says, never taste your wines one day either side of the new moon, because they don't show well. They don't show at their best. And I've checked it out. That is true. Uh-huh. That is true. That's not a good time to taste. So I make sure I taste them several times and I know, okay, yeah, this is it. And it's funny, when you barrel taste people through the cellar, people gravitate towards the same wine. In the back of my mind, I go, okay, this is the base. And now I need more fruit. This lot's fruity. I need more tannin. I need more structure. I need more acidity. And I put them together. And then I taste them with everybody that'll sit still long enough. And I put a glass on my desk the whole day long and see how it evolves over the day. I taste it the next day, you know, and just see where wines are going, because, you know, it's an educated guess to some extent, but you can kind of tell where wines want to go, and then there's where you want them to go. And so, you know, your job as a winemaker is more of a shepherd than a, you know, you're a counselor.
That's a really good way to put it.
You know, you're trying to point them in the right direction without forcing them into being something they don't want to be.
Are you making notes all day long, or is this just sort of, okay, kind of get it?
No, I have a note. You know, I have a paper memory that I write down my tasting notes in. But, you know, I do it over and over and over again. And once I put together, like, I'll put together three wines of, you know, say I'm making a Merlot blend for someone. I'll put together three wines that I like. I'll show them to people and I'll see what people gravitate towards. When I'm doing that, I'm tasting them myself and I'll go, you know what? All of a sudden, I wonder what happens if I put 2% Cab Franc in this blend or something. And so it's an ongoing process. I never do it like sitting down at one time. I can't. My mind doesn't work like that, because it'll drive me crazy. So I want to make sure, like, when I'm getting to the end of the blending process, that I'm pretty sure I've covered all of the variables and, you know, all the different permutations that I can, so that I'm pretty confident that's the best that wine can be. And sometimes I'm wrong, you know? I mean,
it's fair to hear you say that. I don't know if a lot of people would admit to being wrong over something like that. But is it a matter of sometimes that you don't do the same thing twice? Or do you follow that methodology? I mean, or maybe you start going down that path and it changes.
Nah, it usually ends up in the same place,
okay.
I think. I mean, just the way that my mind works, you know. So I'm looking at it starting in the vineyard. I'm lucky enough to see the fruit and go, hey, this year this fruit's not as ripe, or the seeds aren't as ripe. And so from the beginning, I'll treat it different in the winery. You know, I'll make sure I don't want to extract seed tannin and green tannin, so I'll do the pump overs different or whatever it is. And I taste my tanks every day, and I'm pretty religious about tasting the pump overs because that's the first place to mess up your wine. And especially with Bordeaux varieties, and you get some bitter extraction and things as you get more alcohol in the tank. And so I have this guy, Gerardo, that works in the cellar, and he has a great palate. And so I've taught him how to taste, you know, and he understands bitterness. And there's a seed tannic thing that when you pump over 1 minute too long, you start picking it up.
Really?
And so when I write pump over work orders for those guys, I'll say, I think you should pump it over for 15 minutes, but taste it every 5 minutes.
So you're empowering him a bit.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's the best thing you can do. Yeah. It's the best thing you can do is teach your cellar guys flaws, you know, so that when they're racking barrels, they just don't, yeah, let's rack them all together. You know, I want them to smell every barrel before they rack and make, if it has a VA problem or something, they just say, hey, come check this out and see what you think, instead of just doing it robotically.
That's awesome to hear you say
that. Well, it's, I mean, you know, it's because I'm lazy, you know. Well, you know, if I give those guys the tools to do all the things that they need to do, it's just better for me. I mean, it actually is less work for me, and I feel better because I know that those guys are actually paying attention.
But it's smart. The whole thing is, it's smart what you're doing, because other than the fact you're empowering them and you're giving them more pride in what they're doing, they're thinking. They're not just becoming robots.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like giving people shares in the company they work for. You know, I mean, if you let people know that you care what they think, it's always better than, and they have a vested interest, it's always better for any company than just, yeah, I'm going to work and you go home at 5 and forget about it, you know?
Bruce, where are you from originally? Are you native California?
Yeah, I grew up in the Bay Area. I'm one of the few natives left. I mean, when I grew up, everybody's from California. Then everybody moved here and all the Californians moved somewhere else.
Because all the Midwesterners are coming here.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, it's funny you should say that because I live in Milwaukee. 4 or 5 people from California moving to Milwaukee, and I'm looking at them like, really?
Well, really? You know what? They can pay cash for their house in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's a problem. It's gotten expensive to live on the West Coast because it is beautiful, you know? I mean, you look at where we live. We're 3 hours from Tahoe. So we can go to snow. We can go to the desert. We're 1.5 hours from the ocean. I mean, it's a perfect location. You're close to San Francisco. I mean, there's no place better in the world to live if you like to get outdoors and have some metropolitan life, but live in a country setting.
I don't want to, this may be a question you don't want to answer, just, is Sarah actually, you know, moving on, or is it just a matter of that she wants to literally just sort of be on the fringes of what's going on?
No, she wants to be on the fringes more. She's got 3 kids, and, you know, she has a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, she sounds like she's real busy.
Yeah, she has twins, and she's very busy with other projects she has going on and whatnot, and so she wants to remain on the fringes, for sure.
Good. Specifically, let's talk about the wines you're making here. Obviously, I'm well familiar with your cab, but tell me what other wines you're making.
I like to think of it as 3 lines of wine. So we're doing one package. It's an alternative package called the Pouch. It's an Astor Pouch, and it's been a lot of fun. It's kind of made for outdoors. It looks like a kid's juice bag, you know, like it looks like a, you know, whatever. I don't know.
Without the straw. Brand.
Yeah, without the straw, but it's the same kind of material. It holds 1.5 liters, and we're doing a Chardonnay and a Cabernet in that. And I mean, that thing's taken off. I mean, it's crazy how it's done. And it was launched well and sent to a few states to see how it was going to do. And it's done really well. And I think we produced twice as much last year as we had in the plan. So that shows you.
It doesn't surprise me one bit.
I mean, it's, you know, environmentally correct as far as you can hold 2 cases of it. So there's no weight to it. It's cheaper to ship. It's in a container that can be fully recycled. And so it's a cool package.
And it's robust. It's pretty strong.
Yeah.
You don't expect that when you first look at it.
Yeah. So that's kind of one tier. And then we go into the Clymer bottled wines, which is Clymer Red and Clymer White. And Clymer White is Sauvignon Blanc. In past vintages, it's had a couple other varietals blend into it, but it's going to become 100% Sauvignon Blanc brand. And that fruit's sourced from Mendocino County in the Delta. And the growers we're dealing with there that we have contracts with, they're like all the Lodi guys are sustainably farming. And Mendocino, we're moving that way as well. And then Clymer Red is always a blend. It's Zinfandel based, but it has other red varietals. And so, you know, it has some Syrah in it typically and some Cab and Petite Syrah in some years. And so those are both table wines, you know, and they're priced at, I'd have to check, but they're about $15 a bottle.
Yeah, they're very reasonably priced.
Yeah, so they're, you know, so those are wines that are made. They're in a screw cap package made to drink that year, wine that you can afford to drink every day. And then, let's see, then we go into all the wines that are cork finished. There's Gary's Improv, which is always a Napa Valley Zin, and that's a fun wine to make. And people love Zinfandel. It's a fun varietal because there is a certain, like, Zin cult or whatever of people that follow Zinfandel. Oh, I forgot one other wine. We make Route Blanc, which is another Sauvignon Blanc. Sauvignon Blanc based. It actually has a picture of Gary on his bike going over Paso Gavia.
Oh, cool.
And on the white road. Nice. And so that's a higher priced Sauvignon Blanc, and that's a lot of fun to drink. And that's always Napa Valley Appellation, where the climber Sauvignon Blanc is California Appellation. And then let's see. Gary's Improv, the Cab, Kit's Killer Cab, you know, which is always Napa Valley Cab. And then last year we did some Napa Valley Petite Syrah, which it got sold a little bit, not distributed nationally too much. It was mostly through the retail room and for wine club members. Oh, I did forget one. So we do a Bordeaux blend every year called the Climber Limited Release. And that's always a fun wine because it's non-varietal. It's always Bordeaux varieties, but it's whatever the vintage has to present. So we'll pick stuff out of the cellar and make a Cab, Merlot, Petit Verdot, Malbec blend. And it's different every year, but that's a real fun wine to drink too.
Yeah, that's got to be a blast making something like that.
Yeah, well, because there's no rules.
Right, exactly. We don't have the walls to deal with. Do you think that you guys are on the road to being a state at all? Is that what you'd like to be?
Well, probably the Napa Valley wines will be able to go more that way, you know, with the Napa Valley tier. The Climber and the White and the Climber Red and the Pouch probably will never be a state because the volumes are so big that it'd be prohibitive to buy that much real estate. I mean, it just doesn't work for the business model. But I can see the other wines. I mean, the other wines are headed that way. With the purchase of Howl Mountain and grafting the Zin Vineyard up on Howl Mountain, it's, you know, those wines are going to work themselves that way. And, you know, I mean, it could be in the future that we pick up a Sauvignon Blanc vineyard, you know, and that goes that way as well. So the volumes of those wines now are at a point where they could head that way. But the lower tiered wines, I don't see it happening.
If our listeners would like to learn more about Cliff Family Wines, how would they go about that?
First of all, you should like Velovino on your Facebook page because Efren and the crew here are really good at the social media thing. You know, it's like they'll keep you updated. And Velovino is cool because there's a lot of events there. There's music during the summer on the back patio, and there's stuff going on all the time. And they do bike rides from here on Saturdays. And those guys are really good at letting people know. And we also have a great website. So there's a Cliff Family Winery website, which is easy to find. And
the website is
Cliff Family Winery. And I think if you go on that, it kind of links you to everything Cliff, so you can get to Cliff Bar page from there eventually, and Velovino, and kind of let you know what's going on. The other cool thing that we do at Velovino is up on Howl Mountain on Inkgrade at the farm, there's a big organic garden, and so we're part of the community supported agriculture program, and so every week people pick up boxes of produce.
Excellent.
I'm on the list, so every Tuesday, it's cool, every Tuesday you get fresh veggies, you come by and get them, and then you have stuff for the week, and it kind of, you know, I have a vegetable garden too, so it kind of supplements that, but it forces you to cook things you would never cook before because you've never had a rutabaga or whatever.
Well, it is. Just to be able to have, you know, fresh Napa Valley, you know, vegetables. Yeah. I mean, that alone is kind of insane.
Yeah.
So I guess the commute would kill me. That's the only problem. Bruce, again, it's President's Day. Thanks very much for taking the time and getting down here early. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
Find Cliff Family Wines on the web at clifffamilywinery.com or velovinonapavalley.com.
Watch for our 58th podcast, May 2012, featuring Buck, Sue, and Brett Bartolucci of Madonna Estate. And Podcast 59 with Watermark wine owner and winemaker Phil Steinschreiber.
Life Between the Vines was produced by Ray Pfister. Post-production was completed at Fifth Floor Recording Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Edited by Ray Pfister and our intern, Bob Warner. Original music composed by Tim Turton. Narrated by Kay Paskoff. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our web geek is Tim Panicucci. Photography by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2012.